Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.9, The Rise of Muhammad Ali in Egypt. Last week, we concluded our first mini-series on the Greek Revolution, and I hope you did enjoy the mini-series format, because there will be more of this season within a season type of thing coming up, because narrating the collapse of the Ottoman Empire just kind of lends itself to this mini-series structure, because so many revolutions will just start popping off all over the place. And to be able to give all of these events the attention they deserve, we'll be zooming out and then zooming back in a lot. And over the next few episodes, we will be zooming back out as we catch up on the larger developments that have been going on within the wider Ottoman Empire. Then after that, we will zoom back in as we do a deep dive into the Bulgarian Revolution, the events of which will take us up through the Great Eastern Crisis of 1875. And the Great Eastern Crisis will serve as the climax of what I have begun thinking of as part one of this series on the Ottoman collapse. Then, after we get through the events of the Bulgarian Revolution and subsequent Great Eastern Crisis, we will begin part two, which will take us through the Young Turk Revolution of 1908. As has been the case with part one, I really have no idea exactly how long part two will be, but I'm guessing that each of these three parts in this series will ultimately be a trilogy, as part three will cover World War I and end with Ataturk, will be around 15 or so episodes each. So that's where we're at. Part one will end with the Great Eastern Crisis, part two with the Young Turks, and part three with Ataturk and the founding of the Turkish Republic. So there is a lot to look forward to. And if you've been liking what you've been hearing, I encourage you to write a review, give a one-time donation, join on Patreon, or send the podcast over to a friend. We are just getting started over here, and anything and everything helps the podcast to grow. With all that said, on with the show. Within the context of the wider Ottoman Empire, the Greek Revolution was in many ways just a single fire, albeit a major fire, within a much larger conflagration gripping the empire as a whole during the early and mid-19th century. As we discussed at the beginning of our series on the Greek Revolution, one of the main reasons the Greeks were able to hold the Peloponnese and Western Greece for so long was that Sultan Mahmud kind of had bigger things on his plate. First Napoleon, then the rebellious Serbs, then a war with Russia, then a rebellion in Arabia, which we'll talk more about today, then a civil war with Ali Pasha, then the rebellious Greeks, and then a war with the Persians. And finally, the real cherry on top came when the Ottoman navy was all but sunk after the great powers finally intervened in the Greek War of Independence at the Battle of Navarino, the subject of our last episode and the subject of great frustration for old Mahmud. In the aftermath of this European intervention, and really because of it, the Sultan would have to face yet another major war with Russia, which for the Sultan was a much bigger concern than a bunch of uppity Greeks having the audacity to try and break away from his great empire. And as we saw, this war with Russia would end in an unequivocal defeat for the Ottomans. And so Sultan Mahmud would not only be forced to recognize the full independence of Greece, but his other Balkan territories also came under increasing Russian hegemony because of the war. And the Russians were also able to just annex a bunch of territory around the strategic Danube River Delta on the Black Sea. After this humiliating defeat at the hands of the Russians, the Sultan's troubles were not yet over, though, as he would then face what was, if you can believe it, the most existential threat to his power to date, when Muhammad Ali, who had just helped him fight his war against the Greeks, would declare war on the Sultan in 1831. So, where did this dude, Muhammad Ali, come from, and how in the heck did he become more powerful than the Sultan? Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is the subject of today's episode. So, let's talk about Muhammad Ali, the so-called founder of modern Egypt. The early part of Muhammad Ali's life is somewhat obscure, and because much of what is known about his origins comes from Muhammad Ali's own account of events, a lot of what we know about him is wrapped up in his own personal mythology that he wished to project out into the world. But what we do know for sure is that Muhammad Ali was born and raised in the town of Kavala, in what is today northeastern Greece. And even though he was most likely born in 1770, Ali often claimed that he was actually born in 1769, because this was the year that both Napoleon and Napoleon's nemesis, the Duke of Wellington, were also born, two great men of the age to whom Muhammad Ali often compared himself. Ali's ethnic heritage likely traces back to Anatolia in Turkey proper. So even though he was born in modern Greece, Ali was not ethnically Greek, and his family spoke Turkish and practiced Islam. For reasons that will become quickly apparent, Ali later came to be thought of as Albanian. However, this has been shown to be largely erroneous, and he is best understood as either Kurdish or just Turkish. Ali's immediate family was not particularly powerful, wealthy, or illustrious, though they also weren't by any means destitute, and his most important connection early on was his uncle, who was the governor of Kavala. As a young man, Muhammad Ali gained a reputation for being strong-willed and decisive, and proved himself to be a natural leader, cultivating a small clique of followers at a pretty young age. Ali's uncle, the governor, often made use of his talented and bullheaded nephew to complete what were at times somewhat unsavory tasks, such as collecting taxes and unpaid debts, often by force. And to just kind of put it bluntly, early in his life, Muhammad Ali was somewhat of a town bully, and he became known as a man who could get things done and who wasn't particularly afraid of, like, getting his hands dirty. So Ali spent his teen years leading a small gang of followers who had a bit of a knack for getting into trouble. Then, when Ali was around 17 or 18, his financial situation and social standing was pretty significantly boosted when he married a young widower named Amin, who had been left a small fortune after her husband had been tragically murdered. After being married, Ali and Amin would invest her inheritance in the tobacco trade, and they made a pretty good living and would thereafter give birth to 5 children. Ali's marriage to Amin had been arranged by his uncle, likely to try and get his troublesome nephew to settle down and leave his youthful follies behind him. And while this marriage did offer Ali some needed stability, he would still often hang around with his old gang of friends, and this would eventually get him into trouble. One of Muhammad Ali's friends was murdered by his own brother, and upon learning that Ali's uncle, the governor, was housing this fratricidal murderer, likely in order to allow things to settle down for a bit, Ali and his little gang of strongmen stormed into his uncle's house and apprehended the murderer. They then decided to take the law into their own hands and proceeded to hang the poor man. Muhammad Ali's uncle was understandably furious at his nephew's little venture into lawless vigilante justice, and he decided that he needed to once and for all figure out what to do with his ever troublesome and yet undeniably talented nephew. And this is the moment when Muhammad Ali's life really took a turn. His uncle had heard that the Ottoman imperial authorities were raising an army with the hopes of kicking the pesky French forces out of Egypt, as Napoleon had invaded Ottoman Egypt 3 years earlier. Ali's uncle saw this request for troops as the perfect opportunity to get rid of his troublesome nephew in a manner that was still somewhat productive and respectable. And so Muhammad Ali, now 30 years old and with a wife and 5 children, was sent off to Egypt. And Ali himself would likely be the most surprised of anyone to learn that within just a short 4 years, Ali would, somewhat incredibly, find himself the absolute master of the ancient and powerful province of Ottoman Egypt. But for now, Muhammad Ali was second in command of the small group of soldiers coming out of Kavala. However, the group's original leader, the son of Ali's uncle, the governor, got cold feet and abandoned the mission halfway through the trip and returned home. This left Ali in charge of the small contingent of troops from Kavala, who then joined up with what would prove to be a real hodgepodge military force made up of about 4,000 Albanian irregulars, who will become very important for Ali later on, as well as about 1,000 of the Sultan's crack troops. These Ottoman forces were then joined by a British fleet, as the British had begun to rightly fear that Napoleon's Egyptian invasion was actually meant to threaten English colonial possessions in India. This somewhat thrown-together military force would arrive in Egypt in 1801 and find a political and military situation that was complicated, to say the least. After Napoleon's initial invasion, the French were unable to fully conquer the territory for some 3 years now, and the French had been sucked into a quagmire as they met resistance from nearly all sides, with uprisings launched by nomadic Bedouin tribes in the desert, by Egyptian peasants in the countryside, and by merchants and religious leaders in Cairo. Then, on top of all of this, still the most serious threat to the French had consistently been the Mamluks, who were the historic power in Egypt, having ruled the country as warlords for centuries. Now, the Mamluks are an interesting bunch, as they were technically a class of enslaved soldiers, all of whom had been taken as young boys from their home in the Caucasus region around what is today modern Georgia. So, the Mamluks are a lot like the Janissaries, but it would be as if the Janissaries had become so powerful that they were able to overthrow their masters and then gradually establish themselves as a class of military overlords. And this is exactly what the Mamluks of Egypt did in the 13th century, as they established a Mamluk sultanate that would last for close to 300 years, until they were conquered by the Ottomans during Selim the Grim's conquest of the Muslim Middle East, which we talked about in episode 1.1. After the Ottoman conquest, the Mamluks remained powerful and were largely just incorporated into the Ottoman imperial system, having to send taxes off to the Sublime Porte and having to pay lip service to the Ottoman governors who were sent over from Constantinople to keep an eye on them. Throughout this time, the Mamluks would continue to raid the Caucasus region in order to enslave more young men who would fill the ranks of their military bureaucracy. And because they had just been taken to a foreign land, these young recruits would typically grow to have intense loyalty to the Mamluk leadership. So, the Mamluks were an ancient and resilient force that the French could not completely do away with during their expedition, though the French did severely weaken the Mamluks during their years-long campaign against them. And so, this was the incredibly complicated situation in Ottoman Egypt in 1801, with riots and revolts gripping the country, and with the ancient power of the Mamluks having been weakened by the French, but with the French still unable to deal a decisive blow against them. This chaotic environment would ultimately leave a power vacuum that Muhammad Ali would masterfully fill. Now, at this point, Muhammad Ali was still kind of a nobody. Yes, he was the leader of a small contingent of soldiers, but within the grand scheme of things, his force was a very small fish in a very big pond. By July 1801, the combined Ottoman and British forces successfully liberated Cairo, and they were welcomed into the city by jubilant crowds. And then, after things settled down a bit, the Ottomans pulled most of their troops and left the governorship to a man named Husrev Pasha, who would go on to become very important within the Ottoman world, eventually becoming the Grand Vizier. Husrev would also be a lifelong nemesis of Muhammad Ali, as the two would continuously bump into each other as rivals over the next 50-odd years. Husrev, now the governor of Egypt, was given the pretty unenviable task of trying to reassert Ottoman dominance in Egypt, which meant, first and foremost, subduing the Mamluks, who had since the expulsion of the French been kind of just terrorizing the countryside and overtaxing and extorting the peasants. Importantly, the forces that Governor Husrev had at his disposal to subdue the Mamluks were primarily the 4,000-troop Albanian contingent who had been left in Egypt and for which Muhammad Ali was now second in command. Now, the Sultan kind of left Husrev out to dry here, as Husrev didn't really have any good way to pay these Albanians, and this simple fact would precipitate Husrev's downfall as governor, as Muhammad Ali used this lack of funds to his great advantage. With no money to pay his soldiers, Husrev was forced to implement a series of taxes on the population of Cairo, which was quite unpopular, so Muhammad Ali went around encouraging resistance to these taxes. At the same time, Muhammad Ali also encouraged unrest amongst the Albanians, which was not all that difficult, as they were essentially mercenaries who were at this point owed a bunch of back pay, and it was pretty clear that they weren't ever going to get this money from Husrev. This all bubbled over when Muhammad Ali led the Albanians into open mutiny and successfully drove Husrev out of Cairo. Then, as chaos gripped the city, a small group of Janissaries who had been left behind to defend Husrev began skirmishing with the Albanians. And during this fighting, the first in command of the Albanian contingent was beheaded, which left Muhammad Ali in charge of the Albanians, whose loyalty he had at this point cultivated quite skillfully. Then Muhammad Ali led the Albanians to successfully drive out this small Janissary force, which meant that Muhammad Ali, who just a couple of years ago was a small-time tobacco farmer and gangster on the side, now commanded the only significant military force in the great city of Cairo. And this is where Muhammad Ali began doing his best impersonation of Napoleon, as he began kind of just issuing decrees as if he were the governor of Cairo, even though he had no official imperial command whatsoever. And the Sublime Porte would continue to send over a series of governors from Constantinople, because this is kind of what they had always done, but none of these governors were able to control the situation. And Muhammad Ali proved himself to be a master at knowing when to step back and allow these dudes to just kind of be subsumed by the deadly politics of Egypt. When Muhammad Ali welcomed the last of these new governors into the city, he showed him the expected deference, like, "Yes, I'm so glad you are here to take control of this insane situation. Please, let me know how I can assist you." But, of course, Ali knew that the governor had a decree to raise and fund an army. And so Ali had seen this play out many times before with the previous governors, and he knew where all of this was headed. So when this governor put through more taxes, Muhammad Ali used the connections he had now made with the merchants and notables in Cairo to stoke unrest in the city, and a full-on riot broke out, demanding that these taxes be repealed. This mob then successfully deposed the governor, and thereafter asked Muhammad Ali, now acting as arbiter, to take over. Muhammad Ali at first denied this request, of course knowing that they would insist, and after they did indeed insist, he was like, "Okay guys, if you insist, I guess I will become the governor." A weeks-long standoff thereafter ensued between the forces of the now deposed governor and Ali's forces made up of the Albanians and the angry residents of Cairo. During this chaos, the Egyptian notables, who had now declared their allegiance to Muhammad Ali, sent a request to the Sultan for Ali to be made governor. So finally, the imperial government decided that things needed to once and for all be resolved, and they sent an imperial decree which appointed Muhammad Ali as governor. Likely because it had become pretty obvious that Muhammad Ali and his Albanian army were at this point like the only real force in Cairo capable of controlling the situation. And so, through this masterful politicking, Muhammad Ali was now officially the governor of Egypt. Just because he was officially the governor, though, did not mean that Muhammad Ali was the undisputed master of the province, though he will soon be just that after he pulls off his next stunt. As we have said, the Mamluks were a powerful force in the country that no one had been able to suppress. For Muhammad Ali, a newcomer to Egypt, the Mamluks were extremely threatening, and he knew all too well that if he was going to last in Egypt, he would need to get rid of them sooner or later. This need was then compounded by the fact that the Sultan had sent an order to Muhammad Ali, now officially a pasha, to send an army over to Arabia in order to suppress a revolt currently being led by the joint forces of the Wahhabis and the House of Saud, a revolt that Ali will indeed take on. But he knew that he had to secure his power at home before going off on such an adventure. So, Muhammad Ali used these imperial orders as an excuse to hold an official pre-war ceremony in Cairo. Ali sent out messages to all of the leaders of the Mamluks, offering to make a temporary truce and inviting them to the capital in order to take part in an elaborate imperial procession. So the Mamluk leaders would arrive at this event all dressed up in their full military regalia, and they then all went to the Pasha's citadel in order to have coffee with Muhammad Ali before the festivities began. After enjoying this nice breakfast with the Pasha, the Mamluks then left the citadel through a narrow corridor that led back into the city. To the Mamluks' horrified surprise, the gates to each end of the passage were locked, and then the Pasha's personal troops, who had been escorting the Mamluks, began to open fire on them, massacring all 450 of them. Muhammad Ali's soldiers then spread out throughout the city and continued to murder the members of all of these Mamluks' households. Now, this was a pretty crazy thing to do, but the craziest part about it was that it worked flawlessly. Apparently, only three people had been aware of this plan before it actually happened, as secrecy was of the utmost importance. The main confidant of this plan was the Pasha's son, Ibrahim, who, after the main contingent of Mamluk leaders had been killed in the corridor, traveled throughout Egypt, hunting down all of the remaining Mamluk leaders left throughout the country, so that within just a few months, nearly 1,000 Mamluks had been killed, and the Mamluks were completely done away with as a force in Egyptian politics, after being the ruling class of the region for close to 700 years. This was quite the power play. And it was one of those things where the Ottoman imperial leadership was on the one hand like, wow, nice job, dude. We've been trying to get rid of those guys for like half a century. Pretty impressive. And then on the other hand, the Sultan was becoming increasingly worried about this Muhammad Ali guy who was clearly a force to be reckoned with and would have to be dealt with at some point. And this fact was something that Muhammad Ali was very aware of. And his knowledge that a confrontation with the Sultan was pretty much inevitable drove many of his actions in the following decades. So, largely in an effort to secure his position against this inevitable crackdown from the Sublime Porte, Ali grew his power base in Egypt in a few different ways. And this effort to kind of just solidify his own personal rule would forever transform Egypt and would become the reason why Muhammad Ali has since been dubbed the founder of modern Egypt. To begin with, Ali began to invite many of his friends and family from his home in Kavala to come live with him in Egypt. For many of these people, moving to Egypt to work for the Pasha was like a no-brainer, as it almost always meant a significant jump in these people's wealth and status. And of course, Ali was very aware of the fact that his old friends and family pretty much only had him as their sole connection and patron in Egypt, so their loyalty was all but guaranteed. Through this strategy, Muhammad Ali slowly built a ruling class, kind of from scratch, made up of these people from Kavala, with Muhammad Ali's family at the center of his power base. And then, of course, Muhammad Ali himself was at the very top as their great patron and benefactor. After bringing his sons over from Kavala, he began to appoint them to important positions within the military. Shortly after doing away with the Mamluks, Ali finally answered the call of the Sultan and sent his second son to lead a military expedition in order to suppress a rebellious faction over in Arabia. For years now, a movement to reform Sunni Islam had been growing in the Hejaz region, home to the holy pilgrimage sites of Mecca and Medina. This reform movement is typically known as Wahhabism, a name that is pretty much only used by outsiders, but which comes from the movement's leader, Al-Wahhab. Way back in the 1700s, Al-Wahhab, a religious cleric, had, while pushing for his religious reforms, made a strategic alliance with the increasingly powerful House of Saud. Thereafter, the two families, the Al-Wahhab and the House of Saud, formed a power-sharing agreement that would go on to become the first Saudi state. And before you ask, yes, these are the same folks that still rule modern Saudi Arabia to this day. This royal dynasty is, by some estimates, the richest family in the entire world, some putting their net worth at over $1 trillion. So yes, these guys will go on to be pretty dang important, though it will take many years before their power would be truly solidified in Arabia, as they would be one of the many movements to break away from the Ottoman fold in the aftermath of World War I. And of course, they would also need to realize that they were sitting on top of the world's biggest oil reserve. But for now, this first Saudi state had been growing increasingly powerful, and in 1805, they had captured the holy cities of the Hejaz, Mecca and Medina. This action moved the Wahhabis and Sauds from being kind of a mild annoyance to the Sultan to being a major threat to his legitimacy, as the Ottoman sultans took great pride in being the stewards of the holy cities and the regulators of the great Islamic pilgrimage routes. Now, as we have seen over and over, the Sultan himself did not really have the strength to put down regional revolts such as these, and so he had to turn to other regional leaders to help him control rebellious provinces. And because Muhammad Ali was proving himself to be quite a force, the Sultan ordered him to invade the Hejaz in order to suppress the Wahhabi Saudi rebels. This campaign to reconquer the Arabian Peninsula would take years and include many ups and downs, including the death of Muhammad Ali's second son. The Pasha would thereafter send his eldest son, Ibrahim, to take over the Arabian campaign. Ibrahim, who had just proven himself to be quite capable and pretty ruthless in wiping out the Mamluks, would continue his ruthless effectiveness as he led a relentless scorched earth campaign into Arabia, burning down towns and villages, forcing local residents into remote areas, and just devastating the ranks of the Wahhabi Saudi rebels. This was, in many ways, a dress rehearsal for Ibrahim's later campaign to subdue the rebels in Greece, which was also wildly successful and quite ruthless, and which we talked about in our last couple episodes. The success of Ibrahim's campaign in the Hejaz not only solidified the Pasha's eldest son as his most effective military leader, but it also helped to at least temporarily pacify the relationship between Muhammad Ali and the Sultan, as Ali had brought the great Islamic holy cities of the Hejaz, Mecca and Medina, back into the Ottoman fold and temporarily put an end to the rebellious House of Saud. During this period, and we're talking roughly 1810 to 1820, Muhammad Ali had pretty completely solidified his power in Egypt by placating the Sultan through subduing the rebels of the Hejaz, as well as by building his ruling class centered around his friends and family from Kavala. So at this point, Muhammad Ali is a serious force to be reckoned with. I mean, most governors of Egypt would come from the elite class in Constantinople and would serve for only a single year, seeing the post as like a prestigious stepping stone in their career in the imperial bureaucracy. Muhammad Ali had now served as Pasha of Egypt for like 15 years. The Sultan had let this slide because the Pasha had been so helpful in conquering Arabia. However, because such a tenure in Egypt was so unprecedented, both Sultan Mahmud and Muhammad Ali knew that a confrontation between them was all but inevitable. So, knowing the precariousness of his situation, Muhammad Ali was always trying to cook up new ways to protect himself. And this desire to ensure his position in Egypt would lead Muhammad Ali to embark on some pretty major reform projects that would have dramatic and lasting impacts on the future course of Egypt. And then 1821, the same year our friends in Greece were beginning their revolution, would prove to be the year when Ali would really hit his stride and begin to find major success in these reform efforts, transforming both the economy and the military of Egypt. To begin with the economy, in 1821, the Pasha would introduce a new variety of long staple cotton, which had originally been brought to his attention by a French textile engineer. At this point, Muhammad Ali had gradually established a monopoly over a good portion of the agriculture of Egypt, and he would use this monopoly control to force Egyptian peasants to plant this new, very specific strain of cotton. This agricultural experiment would pay huge dividends for Muhammad Ali, as it would eventually make up close to one-third of his entire revenues, with the cotton mostly being sent off to British textile mills. Of course, this new agricultural adventure also led to unprecedented levels of exploitation and control of the lives of everyday people, as peasants who resisted implementing the crop would be severely punished, often by being forced into corvée labor gangs that went around clearing the land for more and more cotton to be planted. Like, okay, if you don't want to plant the cotton instead of your food, you're going to have to come with us and dig these holes. And no, we're not really going to pay you anything since you didn't want to plant the cotton. Muhammad Ali would use the huge economic gains from his long staple cotton to implement other major reforms, mostly centering around the military. Ali had for years now been trying his darndest to modernize the military, but he had not been able to find a permanent solution. At first, he thought he would be able to build an army around his Albanians who had originally brought him to power. However, his efforts to introduce military discipline amongst these mercenaries never went over well. So, the Pasha had then sent his third son down south into the Sudan, and he ordered his son to conquer the territory with the primary goal being, in true Ottoman fashion, to come home with thousands of slaves who could form the basis of a new military force. And though this conquest of the Sudan would greatly enlarge the amount of territory under Muhammad Ali's control, the effort to build an army around Sudanese slaves would not really work out all that well. So, having exhausted these options, the Pasha then made a fateful decision and decided to build an army of conscripts drawn from the local Egyptian population living right under his nose. Now, for us modern observers, this might seem like a normal enough decision, but within the Ottoman context, where armies were typically made up of either foreign mercenaries or enslaved individuals captured from faraway places, the decision to build a European-style modern standing army made up of conscripts drawn from the local population was a major change in military policy within this Ottoman province. The Egyptian peasants conscripted into this new military force would, as you might expect, put up major resistance to their new situation. However, even with this resistance, Muhammad Ali would see success in this effort, as he always made sure that his troops were well fed, and he also began to isolate these military conscripts within secured camps, not allowing them to intermingle with other segments of the population who might, you know, put unsavory ideas into their heads. Central to this military modernization project was a French army officer named Sèvres, who had actually fought with Napoleon at the Battle of Trafalgar and Waterloo, and who would bring European military organization and discipline to the new Egyptian army. Sèvres would eventually, on his own initiative, convert to Islam and change his name to Suleiman, and then he would take over the training of all military officers under Muhammad Ali. Sèvres, aka Suleiman, represents the most dramatic example of a much broader strategy of Muhammad Ali's to bring European experts under his wing and to make use of their knowledge of modern techniques of not only military strategy, but also politics, medicine, economics, and education. With the help of these European consultants, Muhammad Ali would over the next 10 years completely transform Egyptian society as he reformed countless institutions, building modern hospitals, introducing public education, modernizing agriculture and industry, and so on. And while these policies did improve the standard of living for many Egyptians, especially when it came to healthcare, we must also remember that these reforms were primarily implemented specifically in order to support the military, which was quickly becoming the central institution of Egyptian society, with Ali's standing army eventually numbering in the hundreds of thousands. And all of these institutions were modernized specifically in order to support this rapid growth of the military. So this is the so-called birth of modern Egypt. And within the wider Ottoman context, Muhammad Ali had done what many sultans had tried but largely failed to do: introduce European-style modernization in order to keep up with the West. And because Sultan Mahmud had not been able to modernize his army, he could not handle things like the Greek Revolution. And so now we've made it to 1824, and the Sultan was getting handled by these scruffy Greeks, and he knew it. So he turned to the one dude who seemed to be doing things right and asked Muhammad Ali to help him put down these pesky Greeks. And as we saw in our last couple episodes, Muhammad Ali would answer this call by sending his always capable and always ruthless son, Ibrahim, over to subdue the Peloponnese. And as we also saw, Muhammad Ali's brand spanking new Egyptian army was hugely successful in subduing the Greeks. That is, until the great powers intervened and mucked it all up for the Pasha. Now, we have already talked at length about Ibrahim's campaign in the Peloponnese, but just to briefly revisit it here from the Egyptian perspective, the decision of Russia, France, and Great Britain to intervene at the Battle of Navarino put Muhammad Ali in a super precarious situation that he had desperately been hoping to avoid. The Pasha had for months insisted that the great powers were not messing around with their threats to intervene on behalf of the Greeks, but the Sultan simply would not listen. And a huge part of Muhammad Ali's success came from his courting of diplomats, experts, and other professionals from Europe. And then, of course, he had deep commercial ties with Europe, with British factories being hugely important for his wealth. So the fact that Ali was now being put in a position where he had to face off against three of the most formidable European powers severely threatened all that the Pasha had carefully built up over the past two decades. So once the Egyptian Ottoman fleet had been sunk by the allied European powers, and once the Ottomans were yet again mired in an unwinnable war with the Russians, the great Egyptian Pasha decided that he had pretty much reached the limit of his patience with the Sultan. So, after the Ottomans were indeed completely trounced by the Russians, Muhammad Ali saw his opportunity to once and for all resolve things between him and the Sultan. So, in October of 1831, Muhammad Ali used a pretty transparently flimsy pretext to invade Syria, which abutted his Arabian territory and which the Pasha had long wanted to incorporate into his domains. This invasion of Syria would launch a series of wars between Muhammad Ali and the Ottomans that would last the better part of a decade. And during these wars, Muhammad Ali, who had started out as just a run-of-the-mill ruffian tobacco farmer from the middle of nowhere, would defeat the Sultan and become the most powerful force in the entire Ottoman Empire.